yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. First of all, let me begin by apologizing for those of you who may have turned in last week. The internet went down right in the middle of our show, about 20, 25 minutes in, and did not come back up till the next day. So that's why everything got sort of truncated last week. Well, we'll try to pick up on some of those themes last week and as well the themes of this week. Wow, things are really happening in the global economy and in the U.S. economy as well. That's really worth paying some attention to. Okay, like we said last week, we have a new format in the show here. The first 15 minutes or so, we're going to talk about important news, economic news of the past week, and sometimes political news, too. Starting next year, we're going to start looking at deeply looking at these candidates and their economic programs and U.S. presidential election, but let's hold that off a little bit. There's so much news going on as far as the global economy is concerned, which is perched on a precipice here, and it could easily fall off the cliff in 2016. We are in a real transition period here in the global economy ever since the middle of 2014. And it appears to become even more unstable as time goes on, unstable both in terms of the real economy and in terms of the financial instability, which, by the way, once again, is the subject of my just-released book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. I'll be talking about that some more here in the next few weeks. But basically the thesis is that the global economy is slowing rapidly. We are already in a trade recession and an industrial production recession globally. And the only thing holding everything up, of course, is services. But those are beginning to slow now, too, as they do. They typically lag and are far less volatile than construction and manufacturing and exports and so forth. But indications are that we're continuing to move in that direction. At the same time, financial instability is growing beneath the surface here, and that's evident in the huge increase in run-up in debt that has continued and now is accelerating, especially on the corporate side. You know, when you talk about debt as a problem, it's not just the question of the level of debt. It's a question of the ability to service that debt. In other words, have enough liquid assets and cash flow in order to make payments on the debt. And if you don't have enough of that, then you end up with defaults. And defaults mean even more rapid deflation in asset prices, which just throws everything into a turmoil, as we saw in 2008 and 2009. Anyway, we'll be talking more, and I'll mention some findings in my book here as we go through this round-robin look at the global economy. And then in the second half of the show today, I want to focus a little bit more on Japan's fifth recession in 7 years. And what does all that mean, particularly for emerging markets and for all this turmoil going on with central banks in the advanced economies, i.e. the Federal Reserve, which is now about to raise rates incredibly, and yesterday's European Central Bank announcement, which we'll talk about in more detail here today, and Japan, that's waiting in the wings. What we've got is central banks running amok here. They really mucked up the global economy in recovery by providing a massive excess liquidity to their investor friends, banks and private investors, shadow banks and so forth. The whole logic of all that massive liquidity injection, which, by the way, since 2009-10 is about minimum $25 trillion. that the advanced economy central banks, meaning European Central Bank, Bank of England, Swiss National Bank, and Scandinavian banks, etc., EU banks, not just the Eurozone, ECB Bank, and Bank of Japan, and U.S. Federal Reserve, and a few others like Bank of Canada and so forth, have pumped a minimum of $25 trillion into the economy. And the whole idea justified at the time was, we got to bail out the banks, right? If we don't bail out the capitalist banking system, everything will tumble into a true global depression, as it did in the 30s. But, you know, they bailed out the banks within about a year or so in the U.S., and they continued this huge liquidity injection, the U.S. Fed Central Bank. Not only with continued QE of almost $5 trillion, but zero interest rates. That was, if you were a bank, you could go borrow from the central bank virtually nothing. In fact, you could borrow from the Fed and leave your money in the Fed, and the Fed would pay your interest on the free money that you borrowed from it. Yeah, 0.25%. So, just go borrow some money, leave it there, don't use it, and get paid. You know, free money is what all this is about. And the banks have private banking system has become addicted to all this free money. And I wrote about that 3 years ago, that it was addicted. You can go read it on my blog. Are central banks addicted? Is the global banking system addicted to free money? Yes. Because this argument that it was necessary to bail out the banks, at least in the U.S., was concluded here about 2011-12, and the free money has continued to flow. Why? Because of politics, and because they want all that free money, investors, because they just get the free money from the Fed and they go speculate with it. You know, they invest in stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, you know, and make huge capital gains real quick. That's all part of this shift towards financial investment in the global economy. It's much more profitable, much quicker, safer, more liquid, jump in and out than loaning money to companies that have to hire people and make things. You see, it's all about, capitalism's all about making money from money now. It's not making money from making things. And that's why we have such a hard time creating decent jobs, because we're not making things the way we used to. Anyway, let's move on from this theme that central banks are running amok. They are. They keep pumping more and more liquidity into the global economy. The weak links in the global capitalist economy are pumping the most right now. And who are they? Of course, that's Japan, now in its fifth recession in 7 years, despite having injected an equivalent quantitative easing, QE, into its economy greater than the U.S. did. In other words, as a percentage of the size of its economy, Japan has pumped even more into its economy than the U.S. did in the form of QE. And, of course, now the European Central Bank is doing that. They're pumping money in. We'll talk about their decision yesterday to hold off a little bit and why they're doing that. But they will do that again after the first of the year, no doubt, as will Japan, even more so than it has, no doubt. By the way, this whole idea of QE originated in Japan, you know. Earlier in, I think it was like 2004 or 5 or something like that, they tried QE, and they decided it didn't work. Their central bank president there, Shirakawa, his name was, said, oh, this doesn't work. QE doesn't work. Let's stop it. And of course, he stopped it, but all the private investor interest got him dumped. And they brought in this guy, Kuroda, here with Abe, Shinzo Abe, the new prime minister, promised to bring in this guy, Kuroda, who would open the spigot again, the free money. And, he's done that. Japan's QE will even grow more in 2016, as will European ECB. They're both waiting, you see. Both the European central bank run by Mario Draghi and Japanese central bank by Kuroda, they're waiting to see what the Fed does, you see. There's no sense. It makes no sense for them. They've been talking about it. All the rumors are they, the Bank of Japan and European Central Bank, all the rumors are that they are going to increase QE, of course, for several months now, no doubt. And, you know, just the rumors boost the stock markets, which they have in these countries. And we'll talk more about the stock market effects from QE. But they've held off from actually doing it, you see, because they're waiting on the Federal Reserve. They're waiting on the U.S. Fed and what it's going to do with raising interest rates. A little preview, the Fed is going to raise interest rates on December 16th. It's going to be a token interest rate increase, short-term rate, of 0.25%, but that's almost a done deal. That train has left the station now. There's just too much political pressure on the Fed not to raise rates. You know, just another announcement last week, the Republican-run Congress in the U.S. Has pushed through a proposal to take whatever money that the Fed has made on its treasury bond loans and sales of bonds and so forth, was it $30 billion or something like that in the last 5-6 years, drag that money out of the Fed and use it to spend. You know, Republicans and Tea Partiers don't like the Fed because they represent, to some extent, small business interests. And the big beneficiaries of all this Fed central bank liquidity money injection are big investors and big banks, big shadow banks, hedge funds, all those equity firms, etc. They're the guys who are keeping this money, free money thing flowing, the golden goose, because, you can get money for nothing and invest it. If you lose, you don't lose anything because you didn't pay anything for it, and, you might make it big, especially if everyone's doing this, driving up financial asset markets everywhere anyway. So they're all addicted to this. The private banks and investors are addicted to the free money, and the central banks have been just accommodating them, even though the banks, the U.S. banks, have been bailed out for 4 years now. They're still pumping in the money, still pumping in the free money. They can't get off of it. You see, once you start laying those golden eggs, they make sure that goose keeps going. And that's what's been happening. But continuing these zero rates for 7 years now is causing chaos in the real economy. Investors in fixed income, we have 50 million people retired on Social Security, and whatever small savings they have, it's in fixed income of various kinds, unless they're stupid enough to put it in stocks. They're just not earning anything. And really what you got is no earnings on your fixed income, no interest earnings. You've got investors, professional investors, making all the money. So really what you're doing is taking money from mom and pop, grandma and grandpa, and you're giving it to the big investors. You know, that's what the central banks are doing. So it's really a massive income distribution, redistribution. And QE, of course, is redistributing income in other ways as well, from other workers and small businesses and so forth. To the very rich. And that's a major reason why we have so much income inequality. It's not just that wages aren't growing. That's true. Very little wages. Only at the top 10% wage increases are growing, full-time workers, full-time wage and salaries. If you look at the 40, 50 million people who are unemployed and part-time and contingent and working in the gig economy now, they're not making any wage increases at all. Everything they're buying is on credit and debt. Okay, so first announcement here, ECB QE yesterday. What happened? Well, Mario Draghi, the chair of the European Central Bank, surprised everybody negatively. In other words, they all expected another big boost, in the $1.2 trillion, I think it is, of QE that was announced at the beginning of the year for 18 months, 60-some billion a year dollars. They would inject into the economy, the European Central Bank, and they committed for an 18-month period. And with the market, quote, the markets, we hear this term, the markets, no such thing. It's investors, professional investors. They are the markets. They all expected the ECB to really pump this thing up, just like the Japanese did last year. You know, Japanese started out with the QE, and then they massively pumped it up to $1.7 trillion. When at first it had some effect on stocks, and then the stocks stock market slowed down, and they pumped even more in. The Japanese, as I was saying before, well, they expected, investors expected that the ECB would do the same here yesterday. Well, the ECB sort of surprised them to the downside. Very token increases, right? They lowered the central bank interest rate to one-tenth of 1%, in other words, 100 basis points, they call that. So it's just a token decrease in the rate in which the central bank loans. And then they said, the ECB, Draghi, said, well, we're going to extend our commitment to buy $60 billion plus a month to six more months. So instead of 18 months, it now becomes a two-year program. Well, the professional investors expected something much bigger. They expected a boost from $60 billion a month to at least $80 billion a month, and they didn't get it. You know, $20 billion a month more free money, they didn't get it. So that was, you know, kind of a little bit of a surprise to them. And they expected the ECB to do what the Japanese Central Bank has been doing, buying not only government bonds, but moving out and buying corporate bonds and other securities and even equities and other stocks. That's what the Japanese bank is doing. It's buying up everything, you know, flooding the Japanese economy with all this money and buying at great prices, you know, all these securities that investors, not just Japanese, but global investors have on their books. You know, they're all making a killing. You know, if they can't sell the stuff, you always get the government to buy it, you know, and at a good price. You know, we'll make sure politically they buy it from us at a good price. So professional investors were expecting the same to occur in Europe with the ECB, and it surprised them. Okay, so why did Mario and the ECB surprise to the downside? That's the question of the day. Well, you know, it was such a surprise that you know, the markets, quote, the markets, went into a tailspin. You know, stocks dropped everywhere by hundreds of points, you know, 200-300 points in, you know, Germany and the U.S. and so forth. Bonds went into a tailspin everywhere, government bonds and so forth. So, you know, it was a negative reaction. Well, why did he do that? Well, there's several theories here. One is that the Germans within the ECB, you see, the ECB is really a central bank kind of in name only. There's a council there that makes decisions made up of the 17 or 18 national country central banks. Now, Germany has its own central bank, France has its central bank, etc., and they're kind of like a council, and they all agree, and they all have to pretty much unanimously agree for the ECB to make a move. Well, the Germans have been in opposition. They are the most conservative of the central bankers over there. They don't want to have the central bank fund governments. Because they feel that if the governments can be funded by the central bank buying up the bonds of these governments, right? That means the governments can issue more bonds, that it would just stimulate deficit spending by the government, more spending by the government. And the Germans are very conservative in that regard. You know, they're a real retro force there within the ECB. We saw that with their role that they played in putting the squeeze on Greece here with their recent crisis, which is still continuing, by the way. So some say that Mario responded here to this German pressure, opposition. Well, I think, you know, that might have been part of it, but I think there's even more to it here, and that is either one of the following. One, the ECB is waiting on the Fed. You know, why should the ECB make a move to drive down the currency, the euro, which is what a lot of this is about, you know. ECB and central banks the whole idea of QE is not just to provide free money for wealthy investors, but to drive down the value of your currency and make it more competitive for exports, help your real side of your economy sell more exports and therefore boost its manufacturing. That's not working so well anywhere because the global economy and trade is slowing down everywhere. So they're all fighting over a shrinking pie, export trade pie here, and, you know, beggar your neighbor, devalue your currency so you could grab a little bit of Japanese and U.S. sales, and then Japan devalues theirs, and they grab a little bit back. You know, it's dueling QEs, dueling devaluation by means of monetary policy, QE policy here. And they think that that's going to stimulate exports in their domestic real economy sufficiently, but it's not. All it's really doing, all this QE, is feeding the frenzy of financial speculation everywhere. And the speculators are now addicted to the hit they get from this opium of free money by the central bank. Okay, so, you know, you could say that German opposition, but also waiting on the Fed. This makes no sense for the ECB to make a move to devalue their currency when the Fed is about to raise U.S. interest rates, which will raise the value of U.S. currency and thus lower the value of the euro. You know, let's see. I'm sure they're arguing amongst themselves. Let's see what the effect of the Fed rate increase in the middle of December is on lowering the value of the euro. Let's wait on that, and we can always, if necessary, introduce our QE after that for another effect to lower the currency and stimulate. I saw this coming 3 years ago. I wrote also an article. You can also read that on my blog, in addition to the central bank's addicted. An article reviewing what would happen in 2013 and 14, which also appeared in Z Magazine, in which I said the euro will fall to parity with the dollar. At the time, the euro was like $1.40 to the U.S. dollar. And I said, well, you know, this economy is so weak in Europe, it's going to continue to get weaker, and they're going to introduce a QE, I said. Even before they did, a couple of years before they did, and that would drive down the value of the euro to parity with the dollar. Parity, and that was 1 euro equals $1. And they're almost there now. They're at $1.06. This move yesterday bumped it up to 1.09, but it'll fall again to parity. Because Europe is committed, continental Europe, the Eurozone is committed to try to boost its real economy through exports, you see. That's what it's all about. But because of the slowing global economy, that's a dead-end strategy. But it's a strategy that the Germans like because it worked very well within the Eurozone for them. You know, they pumped all their, once the euro was created, Germany had a big advantage with the rest of the periphery in the Eurozone, selling its products to the rest of the periphery. And, of course, the German banks and government loaned a lot of money to the periphery banks and government and economies, got them all in debt, right? But the money it loaned, those economies could then buy German goods. You know, it was a nice little scheme that they got going, neoliberal scheme, and it kind of worked for Germany, exports. So Germany's committed to export-driven growth. And as Germany dominates decisions within the ECB and other bodies there, it's a continual focus on exports. Exports, exports is the way out of this stagnant growth in Europe. But it's not working because the global economy and exports and trade are slowing everywhere. You see, so it's the wrong approach. But in the meantime, all this free money is great for the investors. They love it. So it continues. So the second reason I think the ECB sort of went light yesterday was waiting on the Fed, right? German opposition, yes, okay, placate them a little bit for a while so that they can pump up the economy even more later, and let's wait on the Fed. There's another reason, too, probably, and that is the ECB And the U.S. Federal Reserve and others realize that we are heading for another recession. And we're heading into it when they have no monetary tools left, you see. They've already driven down interest rates to zero, near zero. In some cases in Europe, there's negative. Yes, negative rates, a huge amount of European bank debt and government debt is negative. And it's not really stimulating the real economy. You know, in Europe, there was a report, just the 102 largest banks have over $1 trillion in non-performing loans, $1 trillion. And if you throw in the other banks, it's probably $1.5 trillion of non-performing private bank loans. That's why they can't get the banks to loan anything to real businesses over there. You know, the banking system is broke over there. The same situation in the U.S. There's maybe not $1 trillion at this point, but somewhere between $0.5 trillion and $1 trillion. So that's the equivalent of $2 to $3 trillion just in Europe and the U.S. and in China. It's somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion of non-performing private loans as well. So that's $5 to $6 trillion in non-performing bank loans. And now we don't even know what the emerging markets that are in the tailspin, you know, from Brazil and all the others, how much of non-performing private bank debt exists there. You know, there's somewhere between $5 and $10 trillion of bad bank loans on bank balance sheets, loans to private non-bank businesses. When this next recession comes, you're going to see an escalation of defaults, corporate defaults. It's going to be horrendous. And that's coming. That's coming, no doubt, because we've had this massive buildup in corporate debt over the past five, six years since 2000. You know, and it's the corporate debt that's the problem. It was the problem in 2008-09, not the government debt. You got government debt as a result of bailing out the corporate debt subsidizing corporations over decades as well. And you got consumer debt as wages and incomes don't grow and more consumption is based upon debt-driven consumption rather than wage-income-driven consumption. Okay, so household debt rises for long-term for those reasons, and it really rises, you know, during a crisis on top of a long-term rise. And the government rises slowly, secularly, and then they got to bail out more during each of these crises. But the source, the ultimate source of all this debt and instability from debt is on the corporate side. And that's growing again. You know, studies by the Bank of International Settlements in Geneva, the bank for the central banks, clearly show, their research departments clearly show this huge increase in trillions and trillions of dollars of debt since 2009. And most of it's on the corporate side. And most of that, according to the BIS, is on in emerging market private corporate debt, which is really exposed because a lot of that's in dollars, you see. All the U.S. QE of previous years, a lot of it flowed out to these emerging markets. They borrowed it to expand, and they did for 2 or 3 years, and now they're collapsing again. But they accumulated all this huge dollar debt. So, when interest rates rise, the U.S. dollar rises, those economies are in the tank. They're not making export revenue to pay that huge debt run up, and now the interest rate runs up on the dollar. All these emerging markets are really behind the eight ball. The next crisis is going to flow out of the emerging markets, the next global crisis, and it's going to be a corporate debt crisis, and it's going to emanate from the emerging markets. I mean, look what's happening to Brazil right now. Brazil's a canary in the global economic coal mine here. They are on the cusp of depression, kind of like Greece and Spain and so forth were and are. The latest news is they're GDP, they expect it to drop 5% this year. 1 year. And the year's not even over, you know? And the projection is another 4% next year. Hey, when you're dropping 5% a year, that's 1930s. right? That's the way the U.S. economy dropped the first 5 years, about 5-6% per year. Bang, bang, bang. Down, down, down. And before you know, you got 30-40% contraction of your real economy. And that's Brazil. And is Brazil, you know, the template for a lot of these emerging markets? Yes, to a large extent it is. You know, commodities driven. And, of course, commodity prices and volumes of sales are collapsing as China slows dramatically and the rest of the world stagnates. Right? Japan's in its fifth recession, as I said. Europe is stagnating, growing 0-1%. You know, they had a double dip recession in 2011-13. Now I think they're headed for the same, after a growth, you know, tepid growth of 1% for the last couple of years. And China's not grown at 6.8%. No way. It's grown about half of that. India claims it's growing at 7-8% GDP, after it redefined GDP and doubled its GDP. So, look, you know, just subtract half out of that for India, and you're probably somewhere closer to the reality. So everywhere the global economy is slowing, particularly in emerging markets and even in China. Big problem. At the same time that both Japan and Europe are stagnating and sinking. And then the U.S. economy, they say, oh, is growing so well, right? Well, we'll talk about that some too here shortly. Oil, global oil. Last week, some interesting news. The global price of global oil, what was called West Texas Brent, fell below $40. In other words, it's on another leg down. And today, the Saudis are meeting, and OPEC is meeting in Vienna to discuss what to do about this. And the Saudis aren't really going to do much about this. You know, they want everyone else to join with them. What are the Saudis doing? Well, they're keeping the price very low. By even though the global economy is slowing, they're pumping more and more oil into the economy, keeping the price down. As we said before, the whole purpose of this is to drive its competitors in the U.S., the shale producers, out of business, drive the price down to 40 or less. Some Goldman Sachs, I think, even estimated it could break the $30 per barrel range. Most of these fracking oil producers in the U.S. need to make at least $50, $60. So drive them out of business. That's what the Saudis are all about trying to do, you see. But the price has been so low, it's causing so much havoc within OPEC that there's a revolt going on within OPEC. You know, Venezuela and others are desperate to raise the price of oil here. But the Saudis have this thing going after the U.S. shale producers. And, you know, I think the big U.S. producers, you know, like Exxon and all of them are kind of sitting on the sidelines, you know, hoping that the Saudis win this because if they do, they can just swoop into these oil fracking fields here in Texas and North Dakota and Pennsylvania and cherry pick, you know, the best wells and the best companies. Because a lot of the stuff is driven in the U.S. is driven by newcomers, right? So the Saudis want to drive them out of business if they can. But it's causing the Saudis some havoc in their own economy, too. They're losing a lot of money, and it's causing even greater havoc in places like, you know, Venezuela and Nigeria and so forth, other members of OPEC. But I think they're going to fail because they, the Saudis, are going to fail. Nothing will come out of Vienna. Because now, you know, there's sort of a tacit agreement not to go to war with Iran. And now Iran, the sanctions are being lifted. And Iran says, no way, we're going to start pumping oil. You know, the Saudis aren't going to be very successful in trying to stop the decline in oil, the price of oil, which is going to continue. New glut, new big glut. This is going to last for years. And, you know, the decline in the price of oil, oil is not only a commodity, it's also security, financial security, oil futures. And the decline in oil is closely tied to the rise in the value of the dollar. And the dollar will keep rising. By the way, the U.S. dollar over the past year, roughly, year, 14 months, has risen almost 20% in value. Well, no wonder U.S. manufacturing exports are plummeting now, are contracting. You know, the value of the dollar is up 20%. Yeah. And it's not simply because of oil, of course. There's other factors. Long-term interest rates have been drifting up about 1% over the past year. Right? And that has to do with, in part, other currencies devaluing. Japanese, the yen, and, of course, the euro. And for a little bit here, the Chinese yuan devalued 3-4% here in August. Right? By the way, they talk about China as a currency manipulator. All those dummies in the candidates, particularly on the Republican side, say, "Oh, Chinese a currency manipulator. Oh, bad old Chinese!" Right? Look, the biggest currency manipulator is the Japanese. The yen has dropped 30% to the dollar. And you don't hear anything about that, do you, in the U.S. press? You know, you don't even hear Paul Krugman saying anything about the big, bad Japanese. You know, he's always blasting the Chinese. The Chinese currency is pegged to the dollar within a range of, you know, 2 to 4%. And it has been for years now, for like 5, 6 years. The Chinese aren't currency manipulators. No way. The Japanese are currency manipulators, and of course, so are the Europeans. But the U.S. says nothing about that. Let them, you know, let them devalue their currencies against the dollar, you know, which really whacks U.S. exporters, right? And by the way, to the extent it whacks U.S. export goods, it's an incentive for U.S. multinational manufacturing companies to move offshore even more, and they are. And they're moving more to Mexico again. Okay, so this is, you know, a big problem here with this oil. It has a lot of effect. They say that, you know, lower oil prices means lower gasoline prices, which means U.S. consumers are going to spend more. Well, they're not. You know, when this all began a year ago, I said that, you know, they're not going to do that. They're going to save that money, or they're going to pay down debt with that money, U.S. consumers, and that's exactly what they've been doing. Right, so it's not translating into the economy. Or they're going to use it to pay for rising prices in rents and student loans and all these other things that are going on, which is what's happening. You know, so whatever savings from lower gasoline is going into rents and healthcare costs, huge increases in costs of healthcare going on, and cost of education going on. Those three things: rents, education, and healthcare, all going up rapidly. Especially healthcare. We're about to see people have already got their notices that their premiums, monthly premiums, are in some cases doubling here. You know, beginning of the end of Obamacare. The other big news of last week was China. China getting the green light, the okay, from the International Monetary Fund to include its currency, the yuan, as a reserve currency. With the dollar, the euro, the yen, Swiss franc, right? Those are reserve currencies. We'll talk about that, what that means a little bit. One thing I think it means is that now that China has gotten that okay, China will now have to move towards devaluing its currency, the yuan, even more. It cannot put up with the pressure of the declining yen and declining euro and declining currencies elsewhere in the rest of the world, as emerging markets tank. It cannot tolerate that. It's losing out on massive exports, and it hasn't been able, China, to get its domestic economy up by just consumption, you see. During the boom period, 2010 to 2012, China's economy rose by double digits GDP every year. That was because of massive government investment and the big exports going on. Now China has agreed with the West not to emphasize that. To some extent, they overbuilt the domestic infrastructure in China, particularly in housing and industrial plants and so forth. So there's no more room for that. And then exports globally are slowing everywhere. So they had to turn towards consumption, try to boost consumption in China. That became the new strategy. But, you know, what happened with that new strategy is that, are we having another internet meltdown here? Something's going on the line. I hope we don't have another internet meltdown. They seem to occur on Fridays on my show. Anyway, well, let me continue. I'm going to presume you all can hear me. I'm going to continue talking as if this noise in the background was not really there. What we're going to see is the internet. What we're going to see is the Chinese yuan eventually declining in value. It has to. The Chinese are going to have to turn more towards stimulating their economy through exports, even though it's a fight over a shrinking export trade pie that's going on globally here. So look for that to happen. Look for more QE to happen in Japan, more QE to happen in Europe. And the rise in the interest rates that's going to occur in the U.S. is going to be very temporary here. There's no way the U.S. can sustain rate increases, significant rate increases. Short-term rate increases. The long-term rates will drift up anyway. Okay, so that brings us to this topic of the U.S. economy. Let's look at the U.S. economy a little bit today. And, you know, the numbers came out today for the jobs and shows another 200,000 jobs. And, you know, whoopee, here are 200,000 jobs. You know, that of course, is from only one survey. It's not the other survey. I'm very skeptical of those job numbers because there's such revisions going on here, both in the jobs and U.S. GDP from report to report, that I think they're having some trouble accurately estimating, and the numbers are jumping around too much to be reliable, in my view. But let's look at the U.S. economy. Now, here it is, the beginning of December, and we got a lot of the spin going on that the U.S. economy is fine and it's growing and it's going to continue to grow. You know, 2016 is going to be better than 2015, and we had this 3% boost in GDP in the second quarter and another two-point-something boost in the third quarter of this year. Well, you know, as I've said before, if you look at that, we had a collapse of GDP in the first quarter, and then we had this big inventory buildup, business inventory buildup in the second quarter, which explains a good deal of the growth surge in the second quarter, and to some extent in the third quarter as well. It's this GDP inventory-driven growth here. But we've done that for 4 years in a row, you see. And for 4 years in a row, we get this inventory and, you know, special factors, government spending and elections boost in the summer quarters. And then the economy flattens out or collapses in the winter quarter. 4 years in a row. And to me, that's an indication that there's something wrong with the statistic gathering going on. But what it means is that we probably will see in the first quarter of the coming year, 2016, another sharp decline in U.S. GDP. That's what I'm going to predict. Okay, so what's the basis of that prediction? Well, let's look. We're already seeing manufacturing in the U.S. contract. That's because exports are contracting, slowing, and it's reflecting in manufacturing. You know, a lot of manufactured goods go into exports. Manufacturing index in the U.S. has fallen for the last 5 months, five consecutive months. That's enough to establish a trend. Exports have declined for six straight months. The number, most recent number we have for the manufacturing index is 48.6. If it's below 50, it means the sector is contracting. This is the weakest. The weakest contraction number since 2009, In other words, whatever growth in manufacturing we've had, which was pretty tepid, is now over, and now it's contracting again. And that's reflected both in new orders and production. They're all turned negative. They talked about old jobs in manufacturing. We've created 800,000 jobs since 2009. Yeah, but we lost 1.5 million in 2008-9. So we've only recovered half of the jobs in manufacturing, and now it's slipping, going back again. And as the Fed raises rates and the ECB and Bank of Japan lowers their currencies, right, the dollar's going to rise even more. It's already risen 20%. The U.S. dollar's risen 20% in less than the last year and a half, last 14 months, 20% increase. It's going to increase some more. That's even greater pressure on exports and manufacturing, so you're going to see more negative numbers in manufacturing. Okay, so manufacturing is 12% of GDP. It's not the whole picture, right? But we can expect less capital spending by business going forward because of these huge inventories, which aren't going to be worked off here in this Christmas holiday. Retail sales and consumption sales are going to be fairly poor. We're already seeing it from November numbers here. 27% of all U.S. CEOs say they're going to contract their business spending next year. Right? How about construction? Well, construction is about 6 to 8% of the U.S. economy. There's been some growth in business construction, right? Reflecting the growth in manufacturing before, but this is lagging now, and we're going to see a decline in business construction. Are slowing at least. And how about residential home sales here? Well, home sales, pending home sales, were negative in August and September and only 0.2% here in October. So the whole home sector has stalled. You're not going to get anything out of that. And it's turning down again. You know, we had the big crash, and then we had a little bit of recovery in 2011-12, then we had a double dip in 13, a little recovery in 2014, and now it's turning down again in 2015. And it's turning down again with a situation of which we still have millions of people underwater in terms of the value of their homes, particularly those at median and lower level home prices. You know, we had in 2011, 21% of homeowners were underwater. Negative equity, 21%. Well, today it's still 13.4%. You know, the normal is about 5%, right? And if you look at areas like Chicago, Atlanta, Las Vegas, they're still at 20%, more than 20% of homeowners underwater. You know, whatever residential construction we got going is at the high end, and it's apartments, apartment buildings, right? So don't look for construction to provide any boost in the first quarter. It's a winter quarter anyway. So manufacturing can continue contracting. Business spending won't be very significant. Construction residential is flat. All right, so that leaves what? That leaves consumption and services. Consumption, retail, and so forth is two-thirds of the economy. Right, two-thirds of the economy. It's anemic at best. Anemic. Right, all this online surge in spending—that's only 7% of total consumption. It's not significant yet, right? And as I said, people have taken the low gas prices and they started saving it. We get the highest increase in the savings rate since 2012. Right, rents are up. Right, as a share of household income. Rents are now 35% of household income, almost double what they were in 2011. Okay? And, you know, other costs, rent costs up, a big factor. Student loan cost up. Auto debt up. Yes, autos have been holding up the U.S. economy, no doubt about it. But how far can they go is the question. And why have people been buying so many cars? You know, we're at an 18 million annual sales, which is about the same as 2005. Okay, pretty good auto sales. It's holding up consumption, right? Propping up consumption. Well, it's all on debt, you see. It's not on wages and income. Over $1 trillion now in auto loans out there. And a lot of them are what are called subprime auto loans. In other words, loans to people with credit ratings under 700, who, if they start losing their jobs, are going to turn the keys over to the dealership. Here, take the car back, right? They've been able to sell all of these cars because of this great financing deals. You know, 88% of all autos are now sales are financed, and about a third is leasing. Right? You get these great deals or leasing deals from the auto dealers, and you stretch out the average total years of payment. Now it's higher than 72 months on average. You know, people used to buy cars on 3-year loans. You know, now it's more than twice that. And you sell to people with credit scores under 700, which is now about at 2009 levels, right? And you can keep raising your prices as a result. The auto dealers, the auto manufacturers. So they're raising prices, but they're stretching out the financing, and they're giving more and more financing and more and more deals, and that's what's keeping the auto cycle going, which is already well beyond its normal yearly stretch. Okay, so this could turn down at any time, and therefore the big prop under consumption in the U.S. economy disappears, right? Some say that, oh, well, you know, since 80% of the economy is services, that's what's keeping things going. Yeah, except now it looks like the services index is following the manufacturing index. You know, services, we're 59.1 on the index. In other words, anything over 50 is growth of services, expansion services in October. But that fell more than 4 points here in November. Well, wait a minute, it's supposed to rise in November as pre-holiday, so this is another indication holiday sales may not be that great. New orders for services are down almost 5%. You know, backlogs and employment and everything, they're all slowing or going negative. So this great, you know, service sector economy may not be there in 2016. May not be there. All right, so that's just a sort of a preview of the U.S. economy. We're going to look at the U.S. economy much more after the first of the year to see if we are, once again, for the fifth time since 2009, in an economic relapse. A relapse is what I call a collapse of GDP and growth for one quarter. Now, we have some kind of a cycle going on new here where we get these one-quarter collapses. Slow growth, and then we get excess recovery from the one quarter. We've done this 5 times here now, 4 at least, maybe 5 coming in the U.S. economy. And you average it all out, the booms in the summer and the collapses in the winter, if they're not statistical errors, if they are real, then what we got is a situation where the U.S. economy just can't get going. And the U.S. economy is supposed to be, you know, the great green light here in the global economic world, right? And the rest of them are in deep doo-doo. China's slowing rapidly. The emerging markets are in recessions, deep recessions like Brazil, elsewhere. Global oil and commodity prices continue to collapse. Money is flowing out of the emerging markets. All that QE and stuff that flowed into in 2010-12 is flowing back out of those markets. Emerging markets are desperately trying to keep that money from flowing out because it means the collapse of their stock markets and investment when it does. So what do? They raise their domestic interest rates like Brazil did, the 14%, and that just sort of kills their domestic economy, you see. And in the meantime, their currencies collapse in value, and we have another mode or point in the global currency wars. You see, the QE stuff is feeding these global currency wars, and then the economies slow down regionally here and there. That exacerbates the currency wars. Currency war and currency volatility is an indication of a churning at the end of a cycle, and that the things are about to turn down. Well, that's what we see globally. You know, in the first third of my book, Systemic Fragility, looks at emerging markets in China and what's going on in Japan and Europe, you know, with all these moves that are stimulating currency wars, stimulating capital flight, slowing down all these global economies elsewhere. The first third of that book is empirical, looking at those economies and why the IMF and the World Bank and all of them keep missing the forecast. You know, every year they got to adjust their forecast lower than what they had the previous year. That's the reality of the global economy right now. That's the picture. You know, why is this all happening? Well, it's rooted in nine fundamental trends, I argue, and I talk about those at length in the second part of the book, including slowing real investment, rising global debt, excess liquidity being pumped into the economy, right? A relative shift to financial speculation and investment everywhere, growth of the global finance capital elite that's driving this and all their shadow banks, and then what's happening in labor markets, and why fiscal austerity is the choice everywhere, and central banks continue this free money everywhere. And that's underlying how and why this global economy is slowing periodically. You know, sometimes there's a little reverse back to a little growth, but the long-term trend is a definite slowdown everywhere. And they're not investing in real things very much, so they can't create jobs very much. And the jobs they're creating are now high-paying jobs because they're service jobs, right? You know, that's the affliction of the global economy in the 21st century. It's the new norm. Some call this secular stagnation without describing it. Well, I attempt to describe it in my book. And then in the book, I also address this whole question of, you know, why does the mainstream economics get it so wrong? They keep misforecasting where things are going. Well, it's because their models and their theories are decades out of date. You know, they don't understand finance and finance capital elite and the shadow banks and the restructuring of global financial markets and the restructuring of labor markets that's driving wages and incomes down at the same time. You know, if you're not producing real goods and so forth, you don't need people to have money to buy those real goods and so forth. Therefore, you know, you can pay them less. And that's the restructuring in labor markets. And real wages and income is a reflection of the restructuring in financial markets and this shift to financial investment. And they both exacerbate each other, right? I really take a whack at mainstream economics and its failure and its various wings to really understand what's going on. And I take a little whack at the Marxists as well because they're still focused on real production and falling rate of profit and don't understand the financial changes occurring as well, even though Marx in his unpublished work was sort of pointing in that direction. They don't look at that too much. So there's a problem in the Marxist analysis here. The Minskyans come closest, but, you know, Hyman Minsky, this economist, talked about financial fragility and so forth decades ago, sort of saw the outlines of this, but a lot has changed since he was writing in the 80s and 90s. So, you know, the entire edifice of economic analysis needs to be updated, and I take a whack at that as well in this book, Systemic Fragility. By the way, you can go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and from there you click on the icon. It'll take you to my website, Kiklos Productions, and you can order the book at discount from my website and blog. You can also go to the publisher, Clarity Press, clarityPress.com. /Rasmus, rasmus.html, and order there. And I believe now it's available on Amazon, too. You can order from Amazon. Okay, so next week we're going to continue our look at the U.S. economy and about the rate increase that's coming and talk some more about what's going on with taxes and what's going on with these politicians. Okay, Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.